see many of you were in the session last night too, when we laughed a lot. Today we should be prepared to cry a little. I've been reviewing this morning the text that I'm trying to read, and I keep crying reading these poems. This is the name of the book, The Cancer Poetry Project. I'm sorry that the bookstore doesn't have any copies of it, but your local bookstore may be able to get it. It's poems by cancer patients and those who love them. So there are sections in here, poems written by cancer patients, by another section, by their partners and spouses, another section by caregivers, another section by more extended family members. And one of the things that I find especially moving about this, in addition to the poems themselves, is the brief statement that each of the writers submitted to the editor of this book, explaining a little bit about what happened in the family and what has happened since. And one of the inspiring things that you will hear in their comments are that many of them, this is the first poem they ever wrote, or first poem that was ever published. It was the cancer experience that got them needing to articulate what the whole experience is like, and finding words to put around it, and explanations to oneself and to others about what this has meant to have cancer in the family. I would guess that probably all of us here are either cancer survivors or have loved ones in the immediate family who have suffered cancer, who have extended family members or friends or colleagues who've suffered cancer. It hardly escapes any of us in our culture now. So I've selected from this book some poems which I'd like to read to you. And in many cases, I will read the explanation. As I was going through them again, I thought, oh, I don't need to read what the author said all the time. And then I'd say, I can't leave that one out. I can't leave that one out. So I will intersperse these readings with the author's words. And at any time, if you'd like to chip in and say, that's exactly what I felt like, or that sounds exactly like my mother or my daughter and her breast cancer or whatever, please feel free to express yourself. Almost all of these poems are written by people like us. There are almost no professional poets in here. No poets laureate like Billy Collins, you know, writing here. It's people who decided they needed to write. They go to poetry workshops like those that are going on this week right here in Old Village and get started with writing. And some of these are very hard for me to read and hard for some of us to hear just because of the details that people need to write about. So here we go. I entered the room naked, by Nancy Louise Peterson. I entered the room naked, finally brought the full-length mirror to see my back, shoulder blade to heel, to see my front, ankle to stitched chest, trying to remember how they looked, those nipples, up to my hair that will be gone too in a few weeks. And I paid closer attention to the crease in the back of my leg that I hadn't noticed before, the angle of the curve in my back, The mole at the top of my thigh, the wisp of hair around my lips. I raised the jar to the flat of my head and walked across the hardwood floor full of grace. I caught a glimpse of the swan, her neck movement, a glimpse of the lioness, her shoulder muscle, a glimpse of this ancient one, her padded feet, and I loved her. And this writer said, a big part of my healing from having had breast cancer involved leading writing groups for cancer survivors, says Nancy Louise Peterson, age 54. The process of writing, I entered the room naked, was cathartic. It allowed me to reframe my experience, to still love my body, and to appreciate what I have, and to love the scars too. Here's another one by Terry Hansen, a woman, T-E-R-R-I, entitled Farewell to Hair. I stood outside on a windy day and ran my fingers through my hair. Long strands of silky threads blew across the lawn. They glistened in the sun, too many to count. I imagined a nest lined with my mane woven by a mama bird. The babies nestled snug inside, warmed by my fallen tresses. Now on the wintry nights when my head is cold, I pull my wool cap over my ears and smile as I dream of baby birds sleeping in my hair. Quite a coping device. She was very sad, she writes, from losing her hair. But then I thought of baby birds sleeping in it, and I thought it would be okay. She heard about this cancer poetry project. She wrote her first poem ever, this one, and sent it in.
I thought of that. Emily Dickinson's poem about the hope that thing.
Yeah. Oh,
the birds.
Yep. Here's one called The Cancer Patient Talks Back by Molly Redman. No. I don't want to hear about your uncle and how he lived 3 years after being diagnosed. And I don't want to hear how many times your cousin threw up when she had chemo. Nor how your neighbor's baby had 12 toes, maybe from radiation. And I don't want your sounds of pity simpering about my situation. Pity separates us, and with one out of three getting cancer now, pity won't keep you safe. I have suddenly crossed the boundary line of the risky circle called cancer. It has made me public property, like being largely pregnant. People invade an assault of connections for reasons fair and foul. Strangers on elevators, acquaintances, the medical cadre too. Either way, I am covered with fingerprints, with labels. Yes, I will take hugs, help, plus anger, strength, and love. But the only person I want to hear about is your grandma Ruth, who was diagnosed at 50 and died at 90, skydiving. Otherwise, hold your tongue. And many of us, of course, have endured. We all know how hard it is to know what to say to somebody, and we typically say inappropriate things. And here's the cancer patient talking back. The Molly Redman, the author, writes, I was getting pretty frustrated by all of these acquaintance comments, and I have since learned that this phenomenon has happened to most cancer survivors. I know now that an effective response is to quickly and nicely interrupt at the very beginning and say something like, I need to listen only to stories with happy endings to help me heal. Redmond herself has a happy ending as she is doing well. This is her first published poem. So anytime we think, well, I'm not a poet, how could I write something that says it so well? Until we do it, we don't find out. This one is entitled The Breast by Marlene Rosenfine. Hunting close to the bone, the surgeon moves from clues to the final routing, and then the skin is sewn. His fingers take a part of me so I can keep my life. All night long I sing of pain. Oh, he marvels that I sing so loud, and I that I can sing at all. He is part of the silent wall, and I am of the shouting. This then I give to you, my lover, my forever cockeyed chest. This then I give to you, my child, the stories of before, when two pokey softenings robed me. Little daughter, you dream I grow another breast and cry to wake me. But listen, as we whisper in the fuzzy night, know that I've got two of everything I'll ever need again. Spare parts are to discover what I can do without. Now the next section are poems by partners, spouses, lovers. So it's not the patient herself. This one is entitled Outside the Bone Marrow Unit by John Rybicki. It has been over a year since Julie waved aside the wheelchair and walked in her own bright bones out of that sterilized chamber. The butterfly doors swung open and she stepped into air that 2 weeks earlier could have killed her. I'm worried that thinking about cancer, writing about cancer, will start cancer growing again inside her. Where in that sweet void, where in the wide heavens could it be hiding? I stand on my toes and kiss one of my angels, and in that kiss, I beg her to take a stiff broom to this talk. Sweep the cancer back across the heavens. Please don't miss one crumb of it. Sweep the cancer back into its black box of oblivion. And he writes, what moved me to write these poems was an abundance of grief. From the page, anything is possible, for when we speak with authority, with honesty and audacity and heart, we in many ways reclaim one fistful of God's own fire and drag it down to this world and hurl it across the skin of the page. Julie has crowned my life, and so I insist. I grab God by the scruff of the neck and insist that he allow me to exceed myself, to put the power he planted in me to some good use on my gal's behalf, and out of me springs the holiness of poetry.
That's as beautiful as a poem
was,
you know that.
Yeah, even some of these statements are like poetry.
Yeah.
This one is by Julie Cadwallader Stow, called Guinea Pig. And you know, one other usefulness of poems like these is to prepare us for knowing what to do when cancer might strike very close to home, as this one reveals. As if your cancer weren't enough, the woman writes, addressing her husband, as if your cancer weren't enough, the guinea pig is dying. the kids brought him to me, wrapped in a bath towel. Do something, Mom. Save his life. I'm a good mom. I took time from work. I drove him to the vet. I paid $77 for the guinea pig's antibiotics. Now, after the kids rush off to school, you and I sit on the bed. I hold the guinea pig, since he bites. You fill the syringe, since you've had lots of practice. We administer the foul-smelling medicine to this black-and-white repository of our children's great love, hoping the little fellow will live, admitting to each other, if he doesn't, it'll be good practice for the kids. And she wrote, in submitting this, writing has enormous therapeutic value. Once her husband Warren was diagnosed with advanced multiple myeloma, poetry became an incredibly powerful vehicle for expressing what was going on in our lives. And, you know, that's how these poems can serve them as well as us. Here's one by a writer called Judy Rome, a lesson in memory of Becky Bender. And the editor says that her best friend Becky Bender had been diagnosed with breast cancer before, at the age of 40, and died just a few years later. And Rome said, seeing how the experience of facing death transformed her, how she lived every day in her life taught me a lot about courage. A lesson. At a breast cancer rally, she rises above 16 positive lymph nodes to tell the world that cancer is a wake-up call that resonates to the cell level. It is a lesson taught to trembling hands that squeeze from today a second cup of coffee on a sunny deck with someone you love. It is a slap that sends you flying from Michigan to Cozumel, because cancer teaches that snorkeling coral reefs pays greater dividends than a savings account, and mowing summer grass can be postponed for bike rides past wildflowers and country streams. And vacuuming the carpet and washing the windows are low priority items when a friend drops by to visit. Cancer is not a gift, but a lesson full of seeing now and loving presently. And even up here at Holden, we meet all sorts of people who have recognized that being at a place like this is more important than making sure the lawn is mowed back home. This one is entitled Valentine's Day, 1975, by Patricia Jocelyn, who lost her high school sweetheart and husband when he was 26 and she was 25. This is Valentine's Day, 1975. No white linen tablecloth. No white candles twinkled. No string quartet played sweet music as we dined. Even the meal was nothing more than usual fare. But we were in love. We were quiet through dinner, knowing that all we wanted to say had been said many times over. So we waited, staring into approaching night, with nothing more than the fluorescent track over your bed to shed light on the situation. You were pale and frail by then, your skin stretched thin over fragile bones. Your hair hadn't grown back, so you wore that ill-fitting wig rather than show your baldness. The doctor arrived for evening rounds, dark circles under his eyes, lab coat wrinkled under his arms. Long day, as always. He pulled the old straight-backed chair from the corner of the room, so close that his knee grazed mine. I sat beside you on the bed. The message wasn't news, really. He cried with us, real tears. Later that night, Anne came to hug you. She was your favorite. This is a favorite nurse. She did her best to cheer you, even decorated your IV pole with red paper hearts. She pinned one to your chest and told you she loved you because you had heart. She cried too, then took your blood pressure with the familiar black cuff that hung on the wall. So long ago, yet the white room and red hearts fill a black space that suffocates me still. Now, we've got one of the writers in this book here in the room with us, and I'd like her to read one of both of her poems.
I'll see if I can do that.
This is Rebecca Lee, her daughter.
Yeah, my late husband, Michael, I haven't written about him very much. I did right after he died a few poems, and that was, I can't even remember how Karen got my name or contacted me about this project, but I sort of couldn't go there, and I didn't write very much about him dying. I have more recently, and I haven't even really been able to read this book very much. He died 12 years ago. And was with me in Holden in 96, I think, and he died in 98. He had leukemia and several bone marrow transplants, and was in remission for a while, and I think it was almost 2 years of trying to recover. So I wrote this one after he had died, and I had gone back to Davenport and back to my job at Augustana, and I was living in a little rented house. Up, and I'd sleep up in the attic. That's the setting for this one. It's called Morning Doves. They thrive in the walls of the attic, nesting, love moans, arguments. At first I liked it, their lives next to mine, yet concealed. Today I want them gone. They live and you are dead. They sleep, strut, have babies under the eaves, out of the rain. While you are gray ash and bone bits in a green blown glass bottle downstairs. If I weren't so full of the chasm you left, I would take an axe to the walls, I would slaughter them, and it wouldn't change a thing. I think I won't read this one. I wrote one because I didn't like the word widow, and I think I still don't. But I have another one that was published a little later that was really just about the hospital experience. And so the setting, I guess both of these are about setting as much as, and I already used the setting as the vehicle to talk about it. This one doesn't have a title. How is it sudden, your long death? Shock, fixed, black. Parking lots, ramps, the bright art in the hallways, flagrant flowers, a fish tank in the white places. One latex glove, like petals spilled on the way to or from some room with a horror in it. Glass coffin, rice flour, your skin taking on radiation burn, your heart's new gallop, your eyes without you behind them. The toxic pills, soldiers in small paper cups. Each day the walk past hibiscus blossoms, each day sunny traffic, peculiar trees with white thorns in the bark. Each day with white thorns. Your grip on the bed rail, the acid you vomit, the shiny cards you will not have pinned to the wall, the blood stains. Then exile of such physical scope, my tongue torn from its place, incisions in every lung full of air, every day more frantic, for tokens, strands, an old letter, words in your hand, some evidence that you were here. It was not fabrication, chimera, conceit. Not like anything else, our language, your touch. Water in the Mojave, left off the maps. Wild mustard in the bluffs. In the cornfields, a soft wind. When you died, the sky opened. It does not close. It doesn't. We were talking about that. Enough time goes by. Gertrude Lundholm, some of you know from Holden, was my neighbor. And her husband had died when she was quite young. 40, I think, 45, something like that. And when I came back, she said, everybody's going to tell you that it gets better. And it doesn't get better. It never gets better. But it gets different. And that's enough. And she was right. You know, that carried me a long way when you were reading the section where everybody comes and tries to say something to help. And even having been through that, I don't know what to say to people when they're ill or when they're working with someone who's ill, so I don't know. They're going through it makes you any smarter about it. But anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Here's one by a mother whose son Kevin was diagnosed with cancer the day after his second birthday and lived only 8 months longer. And the poet writes, "My entire life, including my writing, blessed by the experience of knowing Kevin and witnessing his endless joy and courage, even in leaving this world behind." The poem is entitled "Big Sail Today." No one times the disposable diapers right, or the formula for baby wipes. Always half packages remain. Every mother's lap empties out. Still, mine did so in a second, in the space that should have divided one breath from the next. Becoming silence forever. Today, beside two car seats, one crib, three boxes of board books, one stroller, one swing set, Pooh Bear, Tigger and Owl, unopened Play-Doh jars, three-bedroom house and van, all the unsung nursery rhymes, and dreams of Little League wins. I long to put my body, arms, hips, and singing lungs on my garage sale today. In the yard and for sale now, cheap. But no one wants to buy from us. Might be selling dark luck. By noon, I change the sign. Dead tile, child's toys for free. Help yourself. I go into my vacant house, then back out and add in bold letters, "Cancer is not catching." Here's one by Mary Amundsen. It's entitled "A Mother's Despair." The day the doctor cut open my daughter and told us cancer, I washed windows. And this is an adult daughter, unlike the previous one. I washed windows, every window in her house, ferociously and with anger. I sobbed my grief onto every fly speck fingerprint in unwanted spot. My fingers working beside the surgeon's. And when we were done, the windows and her body were clean. She had no fertility left. The windows were spotless. This one is written by a man named Larry Shug, who writes, "I was moved to write this poem out of love and fear for my brother Mike and his wife, as well as for my wife and myself." He adds that many tears went into writing this poem. This brother was diagnosed with lung cancer 4 years ago, despite the fact that he hadn't smoked for nearly 20 years. In fact, he ran marathons, the writer says. He went through the usual chemo radiation therapy to no avail, and his brother died within 8 months. Windstorm. In the eye of the night, I lie awake, half afraid, half in awe of the wind penetrating every crack in my being. I think of my brother and his wife in the next town downwind, open-eyed and clinging to each other as the wind that mocks everything to which we think we're anchored roars through our lives. I see them leaning in the gale, how tightly they must be holding each other, like roots gripping the soil, as my brother's cancer blows away his time. Minutes flying off like shingles from a roof. And I hear the cry in his wife's heart, drowning even the howling outside their walls. I roll closer to my own wife this night, circle her in my arms desperately. I'll end with a few more that are by caregivers, doctors, nurses, so forth. This one is by a physician named David H. Huffman, who has been an oncologist, a cancer doctor, for 30 years. He wrote, "Cancer care is a complicated life. Writing poetry and short stories about my work helps me to reconcile my feelings. It allows me to cope and express myself. I hope it also helps me to be a more sensitive, caring person, to get in touch with my patients' feelings." This is his first poem to be published. The door. The door seems impenetrable. Today is arduous. I have seen patients with cancers of pancreas, gastric, cervix, colon, all unresectable. One person with pancreas cancer fills my conscience, young and dying despite his expectations and prayers. I must be realistic, yet not hopeless. Yet hope for what? He doesn't understand why he's 40 and dealing with this beast. For balance, I try to remember the exhilaration of a patient cured. I can only be forthright and compassionate. Why is it so difficult to enter this room? Maybe someday I will be in that bed. I hope if that time comes, my doctor will be as truthful and considerate. But if she hesitates at the door, I will understand. This one is entitled Leaving the Clinic by Marilyn Taylor. Carrying your own terrible frailness to the edge of the water, you bend your body sharply like a broken stick until you are kneeling in the sand. You say, if the world weren't so damned beautiful, maybe dying wouldn't be so bad. But then you see how a small rain has pocked the creamy skin of the beach overnight, causing snails to leave their sanctuaries, and the pursed hibiscus buds to fatten and explode. And with the sea collapsing around us, thinning to a glassy sheen that blinds you, you hide your face behind your hands and shake with unrequited awe. It is hard to leave this beautiful world. And this will be the last one, because I'm not holding together very well. This is written by a social worker on an oncology floor at a hospital. When she realized that no one was visiting an aggressive patient who had cancer, she decided to make him a priority. He needed someone to talk with him about dying, she says. The floor was so very busy that day that I honestly didn't know his name. I became his family for the next 2 days so he could pass more easily. This poem, I did not know her name, is her first published poem. She kept it under her ink blotter and it worked for 3 years and then finally submitted it for this book. But again, someone like you and me who don't write poetry, and this comes. I did not know his name. I did not know his name, but he held out his hand. I held it. I did not know his name, but he asked to be held. I held him. I did not know his name, but he needed his brow wiped. I washed his face. I did not know his name, but he needed someone. I sat with him. I did not know his name, but he was frightened. I comforted him. I did not know his name, and then he was gone. His name was John.
There are many gifts in that book, but the part that is very moving to me are the medical people and the caregivers, because you hope that if it's you yourself or your loved ones, that people care about you. Mm-hmm. That there is that much depth of human concern beyond their technical skills and knowledge and ability. And that book really reveals
it. I think many of us tend to think that oncologists have just created a shell around themselves. They can't possibly empathize.
Well,
day after day after day.
Surgeons have a certain reputation of just being
right.
Analytical and clinical.
But some of them, you know, are touched as deeply as anyone.
There's a second book.
Yeah, apparently another book full of
these
kinds of poems has been edited by the same person. And if any of you have someone you know who needs to hear words like these, it would be a great gift to somebody who's not coping very well with cancer and hardly knowing how to put words around it. And these not only tear us apart to read them, but they give courage. You have to admire the people who are able to find a way, and this way is writing, to cope with what they're struggling with. And as you can tell, these people writing their first poem ever have done beautiful work that really touch us and speak to the experience of cancer in our lives. Jeannie, you must see that's related to, if you care about somebody who has a problem, and then you become like, you lose that sensitivity, and you know, and it's not bad or anything, but you don't have the same thing, like you're talking about, amen? But you become so strong that it that doesn't touch you, something like that. Is that good or bad?
Yeah, is it good or bad?
Huh?
We heard one poem where the mother says that her remembering how her two-year-old cheerfully, you know, went through the last months of his life, and that has given her strength. Sometimes we take strength from any little thing that seems to be positive in what is at best a horrible experience. And seeing others, seeing a cancer sufferer carry on for however long they are able, often strengthens us. And if we give the right support, you know, they can get some strength from us.
I think one of the ways that book would be really supportive to people is that just the mere act of writing is an act of hope. I mean, writing a poem,
that's right,
is an act of hope. And so I think if I could imagine people in any of those positions, you know, survivor,
yeah,
could read those and say, you know, that people do beautiful things,
yeah,
when they have these things.
Yeah. I mean, there are certain kinds of art, painting, sculpting, pottery, writing, that are therapeutic, that are healing in themselves, or at least partially healing for those who are suffering. And yeah, a book like this, and as a couple of these writers said, they have gone on and have given workshops in hospitals or for cancer patients and their families to help others write about this horrible thing. And painful as it is to hear a poem about a woman looking at herself in the full-length mirror for the first time after a mastectomy and yet able to put a pot on her head and walk across the room, glance in the mirror and see the swan, to see the lion, to see the beauty and the muscle that's still there. It's got to be an inspiration at various times to certain people. Well, I think we all need a little sunshine. I do. Thank you for being here on Friday. I found another such book edited by one of my former students who has collected poems about families dealing with Alzheimer's disease. So we'll do a similar kind of thing on Friday. But it's emotionally wrenching, so we have to find the similarity today as well. Any sunshine.
You mentioned the thing about art being a kind of therapy or salvation, but the thing that is special about writing is that we can all do it. You know, you need a piece of paper, a pencil,
yeah,
some quiet. Ooh, it went to power. And
yeah,
that's. It's like certain kinds of sports where you need all the equipment, that you can go for a walk and all you need is some shoes.
Yeah.
Writing is kind of like that.
Yeah, that's right. So, you're doing it already, encouragement to...